ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake. Great to be with you for Soul Search, the show curious about spirituality and the ways that we make and find meaning. How easily, or not, do you ever feel at home? And what kind of home do you long for, deep down?
Home is not all it should be yet. There's this huge gap between, I think, what is and what should be. And yes, I did want to speak into that gap and point it out, in the hope always that we move towards closing that gap. I think that is part of the work that we can do in this world that we find ourselves in, that we're not in forever either. Even if you're born, live and die in the same physical house, we can't stay forever. So what do we do while we're here? And I think maybe that's part of it.
Miriam Weiwei Low is an award-winning poet. She's currently based in Western Australia, but over the years she's made a home in many different parts of the world. She writes about cultural identity, about motherhood, and about domesticity. And she sees a place for poetry in exploring our longing for home and its complications. Hello, Miriam. It is great to be with you.
Hello, Meredith. I'm so pleased to be here.
Me too. Tell me a little bit about your background to begin with, not just where you grew up, but where and when would you say you first felt at home?
Oh, well, I am a mixed race, mixed place person. So in some ways, I guess I've felt at home in many different places, and I've also felt uneasy in many different places. And it's really depended on context.
Mixed race, mixed place is an interesting summation.
And it rhymes. That's the poetry. <isn't it? laughs>
Yeah, there's a lot more to poetry than rhyme, as you know.
Yes, but it's a nice component.
Isn't it? Can you tease out the relationship of race and place for me a little bit? How would you narrate that, that sense of ease and dis-ease, perhaps?
Yeah, so the story that I tell and that often comes up when I have to write a bio is I start with Miriam Weiwei Low was born to an Anglo-Australian mother and a Chinese Malaysian father in Canada. She grew up in Singapore, but now she lives in Australia. So I guess I'm naming lots of things that are both embodied people and actual places that people live in, but they're not linear, they're multiple in a sense. So that's, I guess, part of what I'm grappling with when people ask that loaded question, where do you come from?
Yeah. And the thing is, we don't think of our parents as coming from an Anglo-Australian background or something else. Like, that's not how we experience our parents either, especially as children.
No, but they are the people that they are and the things that, well, we're supported by our parents. Babies aren't really able to look after themselves. And no. I suppose we experience, maybe that's a first place of home, that attachment to a parent. Perhaps it's there in that act of being fed from a breast, that sense of closeness or belonging or even interdependency. And I think it's an embodied thing very early in our lives. So yes, I didn't know my mother and father's stories when I was very, very young, but I experienced their care and welcome in a bodily form.
Interesting. It's an embodied relationship, perhaps, and only one possible notion of home. You said mixed race, mixed place. What about mixed faith? Could you just sketch for me the kind of religious or even spiritual context that you grew up in? And where does that, I guess, fit into a sense of home for you?
Yeah, so I didn't grow up in a conventional Christian sort of family. My parents, well, I'll talk about my dad first, who grew up with traditional Chinese religion, which is this interesting mix of ancestor worship, Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, all mixed together and practiced. But by the time he'd met my mother, he'd been studying science for a long time, and he was pretty much a functional atheist, I think, though he respected the tradition and culture he'd grown up in. My mother thought she was Christian because she was born in Australia. She was white, and that was it. It was just a label. It didn't mean much to her. I think her family went to church at Christmas and Easter, but that was it.
Yep.
So, yeah, I guess growing up, they moved around a lot, especially initially, which is why I was born in Canada. And yeah, they were on their own journey that took them eventually to Singapore, where they settled. And when they were there, they began a journey towards a Christian faith. So that's what I grew up with.
So you kind of arrived in the middle of that journey for your parents, would you say, in terms of that faith journey, if I can put it that way? Or what did that mean for you? Christmas and Easter at church, or what did that look like?
No, it actually meant being drawn into a really beautiful community in my growing up years. And it was a community that wasn't perfect, but made a big difference to our family. I could see that. It was something that I decided was what I wanted from quite a young age. And even though I wrestle with many things now as I get older, it is still something that I want to be part of.
Something that you wanted as a young person. That's a really interesting way to describe a movement towards a community, a faith. Yeah. It's not a language I hear very often, actually, the language of wanting, of desire, I guess you could say.
No, nothing was forced on me. I'm grateful for that, actually, that I was given space to explore and to find my own way to whatever it was that I wanted to believe in. That's not an easy thing to do, to offer your children, but I did feel like I had a choice.
Yeah, wow. I'm sure we'll come back to that, Miriam. And where does kind of writing poetry or taking up language as a tool for exploring, where does that kind of begin to emerge in your story?
Oh, I always loved the music and the art of language. And my mother tells me that when I was very little, I used to pretend that I could read. So I loved nursery rhymes. They were my favourite thing, and I wanted them read to me over and over again. And I would memorise them and sit there flipping the pages and saying the words because I loved the words.
Yeah.
And people would think I could read, but I couldn't actually, not at that point. But I actually started writing probably when I was 5.
Really?
Making 5? Up my own rhymes and stories.
Wow. In English at that point?
Yeah, mostly in English. Though we were living in Singapore at that point, and coming into another language, which was my father's language, was also a gift and a beautiful thing. That is why my parents moved to Singapore. My dad wanted to have, I guess, a broader linguistic and cultural education that was then what was available in the West at that time. So he ended up in Singapore.
He had an idea maybe that a kind of multilingualism was one path to being at home in the world? Could I put it like that?
Yes.
Do you think that's what was going on? Yeah.
Yeah, I do. And I think strategically, there's no perfect choices, but it was a good choice at that time and in that place. And for us as a family, it was a good choice.
Hmm.
Because it was a place where it was more possible at the time to have many voices, to be a mixed race, mixed place person, and for that to be more okay.
Hmm. You've been writing, have you been writing ever since you were five?
Yes, on and off. And look, and I don't want to pretend that writing is all I do all the time.
No, it isn't. And I want to talk to you about the other things too.
Good. Yeah, but it is a practice that I've maintained. It's sometimes in fits and starts, but I still find I don't feel whole without writing. I don't feel right. I need to do it. I want to do it.
So what happens when you don't? Can I ask?
I get very cranky and difficult to live with and unhappy. I think there's something about writing. Well, it is a kind of processing. It's the gift of words allows us to figure out who we are, to make meaning, to find ourselves in the world, in a world that's always changing. I mean, uncertainty and change is just part of being alive, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there's something about language and using language ourselves to name things, to work out what we're feeling, to work out what we're thinking. There's something about that that brings us into ourselves, that brings us into being human and in a fuller way. And so I have to find ways to keep practicing, even when there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Yeah, which inevitably there is, right?
Inevitably.
Yeah. Miriam, one of your very best known poems is called Home. It's featured in the New South Wales HSC English syllabus. This poem kind of has three movements, but I wonder if you would mind reading just the first of those now. Is that okay?
Sure, that's fine. I'm happy to read it. And one of the things that I say when I do school presentations on this poem is that Home is a series of three poems. They are nested under one title. So I'll say that again because people get terribly confused and think they're separate poems, but they're nested under one title. So there we go.
Mm.
Right, the first movement. I like that term too. One day I will find it. I'll follow the smell of food. Fried ikan bilis, roast lamb, mangoes, or the sound of water touching down on sand, stones, mud. Perhaps the code for entry will be in Braille, and I must stand in a dark room at midnight weeping and running my finger over two stone tablets. It will be in my mouth, a thin wafer of honey, the bitter salt taste of my husband's sweat. I will see it, I'm sure, yellow as wattle in winter and brown as the grass under snow. It will be a skyscraper, 50 stories tall. It will be the smallest, most picturesque cottage. I will live there alone and with everyone I love. No children are raped there. No one eats while others go hungry. No lying awake, wondering which woman or child in what sweatshop has made these pyjamas I wear, or the sheets on the bed, or the rug on the floor. I will not have to lock the door.
Miriam Weiwei-Lo, reading the first of three poems that she's nested together under the title Home. Perhaps home is less a place than a collection of sights and smells.
How is home different when the front door can be left unlocked? I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search, by podcast on Radio Australia and on ABC Radio National. I wonder what inspired Miriam to write this particular poem.
Yeah, so probably context. At the time I wrote the poem, I was living with my husband and young children. They were very young. They were all under six. Wow. In a little manse in Margaret River behind the Baptist Church. And there was a tension to be in that place at that time because it was a beautiful little house and a beautiful community. And I was grateful to be there, but it wasn't my house. And I struggled with that. I, at a time when your kids are young, there is that such a strong nesting urge. And I wanted my own home, but I didn't have my own home. So part of, I think, why I wrote the poem was to wrestle with that tension and to come, well, I mean, coming to a place of acceptance just happened through the writing. It wasn't what I was consciously aiming for, but I think it is something poetry helps us to do. It helps us to articulate the tensions, but also come to some kind of acceptance at any given point.
Years on from writing this meditation, one of many meditations on home, what does it feel like to read? I mean, to carry it still? What's that like?
Yeah, it still resonates. A part of me thinks, wow, did I write that?
Was that I can me? See why. Wow.
It's not bad. Oh, so yes, look, I think with any work that you have written some time ago, part of you, the older you, looks back and thinks, and there is a little bit of distance, and I think, wow, that was me then. And there is a little bit of distance, but at the same time, there's still that connection. And it's not discombobulating in the sense that I still hold those tensions, though perhaps they aren't as twisted as tight as they used to be. But there's still a resonance. This is not something I've changed my mind about.
I mean, I'm struck, especially hearing you read, Miriam, how sensory home is in the way you've presented it here, and how it's also the fruit of a kind of memory, even at the time of writing.
Mm.
It's placed, but it's much more than a place, isn't it?
Yeah. When I read it, I think, wow, this is the sum of my memories up to that point in sensory detail. So it's feelings, but it's also very specific things like fried ikanbilis and grass under snow, which honestly was a memory from that very brief time in childhood that I had in Canada.
Mm. A long way from Margaret River.
That's right. But that's the only thing I remember is the snow and the grass under the snow. I mean, a few memories, but they're all related to the cold. Ice skating.
Yeah, wow. But it's also this idea of how home can be complicated by the unease of an awareness of injustice, whether it's the injustice of what we're wearing or that's occurring someplace else in the world. And I guess one of the things that drew me to this particular movement of the poem is, I mean, we live in a world that is so... it's devastating, this one planet that we call our home. It's almost impossible to live here. And yet we must, and we do, and it's our only home. And I guess the tensions around how can you ever feel at home in a place where these things happen, you put your finger on that in a way that made it tangible, I guess, and immediate, that it just really, it startles me every time. And I wonder what, it makes me wonder if home do we feel at home? Where does injustice fit into that?
Yeah, I think injustice reminds us that home is not all it should be yet.
Hmm.
That there's this huge gap between, I think, what is and what should be. And yes, I did want to speak into that gap and point it out. in the hope always that we move towards closing that gap. I think that is part of the work that we can do in this world that we find ourselves in, that we're not in forever either. Even if you're born, live and die in the same physical house, we can't stay forever. So what do we do while we're here? And I think maybe that's part of it. I don't find that easy work to do. And I wish we lived in a world where children weren't raped and where people weren't hungry, but we don't. And maybe, just maybe, part of why we're here is to do something about it. Don't ask me what. Something. And I think what that means in our individual contexts is different for every person. But I think we are able to move towards closing that gap if we want to.
We were using the language of music to describe the writing you've done, perhaps in a way of addressing yourself to that gap, right? You use the language of resonance. I spoke of movements. And these are metaphors, and yet they're not just metaphors, because I know that this poem has been reinterpreted as a piece of music. A composer has used a bassoon and a cello and a piano to set this out into the world in that way. And I wonder how you see the afterlife in that sense of this poem, as that question of home remains. How do you reflect on seeing other artists take it up and move it out?
Yeah, so that's Naomi Brown's work that you're talking about there. She's someone I knew when we lived in Queensland. She was a friend when I was doing my postgraduate degree. And it was lovely to reconnect with her and for her to find something in the poem and to want to respond to that artistically. And I think that's that call and response to put something out into the world and have someone respond to it by making something of their own. It's just beautiful. It's a joy to see that happen, and a gift. There is something valuable in just the act of making art, in the act of making something that is very humanizing for the people who are engaged in it, and perhaps something very humanizing for the people who receive it. It's a gift, isn't it? We give it, we receive it, and there's something about that that takes us out of life simply as survival and paying the bills. It's a necessary gratuity.
That's interesting. I mean, C.S. Lewis said something like that kind of art, it's not necessary for survival, and yet it makes survival valuable. Something like that.
Yes. Yes. He has a lot of interesting things to say about art. And yeah. Another thing that he talks about actually is Sehnsucht, that sense of that longing for something intangible that draws us beyond ourselves and lifts our eyes to the horizon, or however you want to conceive of it. That good art creates that sense of longing. Perhaps it's longing for the divine or an understanding that perhaps all will be well in the end, but at the same time grounded in that painful awareness that all is not as it should be yet.
Thank you.
by podcast with ABC Listen and on ABC Radio National. You're listening to Soul Search. My name's Meredith Lake, and I'm in conversation today with the West Australian poet, Miriam Weiwei-Low. Miriam, one of the big themes of your writing, I think, is domesticity, which is not quite the same thing as a sense of home, but I'm interested in how a sense of home intersects with the domestic, perhaps with motherhood, with household work. And you did say before that, you know, writing for you occurs within all the other things that go on in your life. And I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit on how, I guess, the domestic features in your life and in your writing, how do those things come together or converge?
Well, I chose to have children, and I wanted to be a present, well, how do you say these things without falling into the dangers of judgment? I wanted to be at home for them when they were little. And so I spent a lot of my time doing the labour or the work of child rearing and housework. I don't know how to think about those things now that I'm less intensely in that space. It's a very intense experience to be at home with small children. It never stops. There's no off button.
It's true.
And just, I guess, maybe part of poetry. When I was in that very intense phase of having children and being at home, I think I would read one poem a day and that would help keep me sane because it was something that was for me. But yeah, it was also hard to have to fight for that, to fight to make that time and that space, to remember that the giving wasn't all that I was, that I could have something that was for me too, that was either the reading or the writing. And I want to add that I have a very supportive partner. And I wasn't alone in that journey. But being in that space was a very all-consuming experience. And poetry was a way to cope, to carve out a little space that could be for me where I could do that gratuitous work of making art, where it didn't have to be about who needed to get to school and what meal needed to be made and the mess on the floor or anything like that. It could be something else. But it's an interesting, and maybe I will get a little political here. Maybe it's because I've been reading Mary Harrington. but why is it that work, and it is work, rearing children is work, and doing housework is work, why is it that that work is not valued to the same degree as other sorts of work? You can pan out and say, why is it that cleaners and childcare workers don't get paid as much as bankers and doctors, even though the work that they/we do is just as important? That troubles me. It troubled me when I was in it because I could see that if you did it well, if you paid attention, cared, it mattered. It made a difference to the lives of the people that I was raising. But why? Why did it exist in this sort of outside remuneration kind of world when it was real work? And I will say, I was raising my children when Peter Costello brought in family tax benefit. And I really appreciated that. No matter what else I thought about his political policies, I did actually really appreciate that because it was a kind of a valuing of the work that I was doing at that point.
So much of what you're saying is resonating with me, Miriam, and including just the deep ambivalence that I think we can have as individuals when whatever choices we've made in this area, but certainly as a society around domestic work, the profound ambivalence, I think, about why it matters, how we signal its value, the limits of money as a signifier of value, all those things. When yeah, so much seems to be at stake, both for the carer and those receiving that care, and for the society that we all belong to, right?
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, but it sounds like you, in the midst of it all, found time to write.
Yes.
And I'm curious that you still describe that as gratuitous. It's not. It sounds so much more important than gratuitous to me.
Ah, right. Okay, you mean gratuitous in the pejorative sense. I didn't mean it in that sense. I meant beautiful gratuity, the extra that we can have rather than unnecessary. So I'm just clarifying there.
Mm.
Gratuitous can have a pejorative connotation. We can see it as that frivolous thing that we don't need. But I guess I meant that beautiful thing that we do need, the necessary gratuity.
Miriam, one of your more recent poems explores a really different experience of domestic life in a home that turned out to be unsafe for your neighbourhood friend and her children.
Mm.
And if it's okay, I'd like to talk about this with you. Can you tell me about writing your poem in memory of Katrina Miles and what prompted the writing, I guess?
Oh, wow. Yes, that was a hard poem to write.
Oh, partly, sure. It's a hard poem to read.
Yeah, partly because what happened was so awful. I just didn't want to think about it for so long.
Hmm.
But how did I come to write it? You know, I was at a poetry conference in Canberra. I think it might have been 2023. Mm. And I was sitting at a table. It was a dinner. I was with a few other poets, Emily Collier, Dennis Haskell, and another poet whom I should know. I can see her face. I know her work. She writes wonderful historical poems, but her name has dropped out of my head. It's this iron deficiency. I'm sorry. Names, they fall out of my head. A wonderful poet who asked me, we were just talking about our lives, and I mentioned that I brought up my children in Margaret River, and she said, oh, did you know that family that died in the terrible murder-suicide? And I just froze. I looked at her and I said, yes, and I started shaking all over. And at that point, I knew that I had undealt with things that I needed to face and address and think and pray and process. And what is poetry for if it's not for finding ways to face unspeakable things?
Do you think poetry can do that? I mean, you're talking about just a horrendous, horrendous thing that happened that in a way resists. Well, I'm undecided about, do the worst things that happen resist explanation, or do they demand one? Maybe that's the gap poetry steps into. I don't know. How did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it might be a both and sort of thing. So for those who don't know, and I'm just thinking I might actually name this thing here that we're talking about, which is the 2018 Osmington murder-suicide case, where a grandfather killed his daughter and her four children in the morning while they slept. He shot them, and then he shot his wife, and then he shot himself. And that daughter that he killed was a friend of mine, Katrina Miles. And yeah, how do you even begin to think about that? It's very hard. And here's the thing with poetry, and I do think poetry as an art form, and maybe other sorts of artists will want to disagree with me here, but I do think it has unique capabilities in this space. First of all, because it has the capacity to represent fragments when we face something unspeakable and shattering. It's like we fall to pieces. It's like even thinking about the thing that happened is in these pieces. And with poetry, just think about things like broken lines or single images. You can start to pick up pieces. You can represent them in some way. And there's something about the act of writing a poem where you're bringing the pieces together that is integrating in a weird kind of way. Poetry has a unique capacity, I think, to capture the paradox of broken wholeness.
The paradox of broken wholeness.
Mm. Yep.
Wow. That phrase, I think, must have been years in the forging.
Yeah. Actually, I was sitting in a cafe opposite the ABC studios this morning going over my notes, and that's the word I found. That's the phrase I found, the paradox of broken wholeness. That's what poetry can be and do. It can offer that. And I think when you're processing something that's really, really difficult to think about, poetry can be helpful in that way, both to read and to write.
Miriam, you said that it took years for you to reach a point where you could even begin to write about what happened. And you've said elsewhere that there was a kind of impasse, a spiritual impasse even, that you needed to somehow navigate in and by writing. And I wonder if you could just say something about what this has meant for you in what you might call your spiritual life. These things can have such a complicated relationship to our faith. Often they turn our worlds upside down and inside out in ways that aren't always predictable. And I guess I wonder about what that's involved for you.
Yeah, well, don't we all wish we could live lives without pain? It's part of us, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think. But at the same time, if there is a God, and I think there might be still, God brings us to points where we can't escape the pain. It's just there, and we see the world in its absolute utter brokenness, and it enters us, and we wrestle with it, and we cry out, "Why? Why? How could you let this happen? What on earth does it mean? How could this be?" And yeah, yes, that is where this took me. And I had to face it. Look, I think not wanting to face it is normal. Mm. Like, that's part of the journey. I think encouraging people and having tools for if and when they're ready. And I was ready 5 years after that happened to think about it and to name it and to ask the hard questions of God. Why?
Was there an answer? I ask because the answer is unlikely to be simple. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in my experience, to the extent there's an answer, it's relational, not doctrinal, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally. Makes sense. I wish I could ask you questions, Meredith.
I haven't figured much out, Miriam. But what happened when you asked the question on a poetic level and as a writer, but also just as someone who continues to want that faith?
Yeah. So to echo something you've just said, I haven't figured it all out, but I have raged my rage. I have spat my questions out. I have shaken my fist. And I don't have all the answers. I think that's part of the answer, is to know that I don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
But I'm still hoping that all will be well in the end, somehow. Somehow. I still have it in me to trust. I don't know how or why, but the questioning and the raging and the asking why didn't take me further. It took me closer.
In the second movement of your poem, Home, the second movement, at least to me as a reader, evokes the kind of cosmic creation accounts that we find in that most mystical of Gospels, the Gospel of John.
Yes.
And I don't know if that's a text that you had in mind, but certainly that's what it reminded me of. And you write about the translation of the corrupt language of your body into the pure language of that other place, which sounds on one level very pious and on another so difficult. And I wonder what you make of that now, and how does it connect to the kind of stubborn hope you still have?
Yeah, that's a good question. Perhaps I will answer it by asking another question, and that is, why do we still long for something better? If there isn't something better, why do we still long for something better? Another unanswerable question, I'm sorry.
I like the questions that we can't answer. I think they're helpful.
Yeah, well, there's a paradox in there too.
Isn't there?
The reading that I did on speaking the unspeakable, and I did write an academic paper with another poet called Emily Collier, where we sort of unpack this each in our own contexts, and we looked at a whole range of sort of people who've written on speaking the unspeakable, and how it in itself it's a paradox, because we gesture towards something that's either so terrible or so wonderful that it's sort of beyond words, and then we feel compelled to go and try our best to find words anyway, even though it's beyond capturing absolutely in words, but there still is that impulse to find something. And maybe that's it, that there is sort of that absolute that you never get to, perhaps in this life, but that you can move towards or away from. And part of asking questions is to be on that journey.
So can I ask, when you think of home now, what kind of things do you think of? It sounds almost future-oriented listening to you.
So there's my current home, which I love. I'm in a little cottage in Hilton, which is in the Shire of Fremantle, and it's small, it's old, but I have a garden, which I love. I love gardening. I love growing plants. And that is home. But I guess because we've moved so much, I'm also aware that it's not home forever. And so there is still that knowing that it's not forever, and accepting that I'm in my early 50s, you know. It's all downhill from here, Meredith. My body is already starting to get a bit difficult. So So mm-hmm. awareness of mortality, I think, is real. So, yeah, still holding out for a better place. Hope so.
Well, Miriam, could I ask you to read that second movement of Home by way of drawing these things together, perhaps?
Sure. Without warning, an explosion of light, a word that is itself, a word to possess me, an image so bright and complete, it can only be seen with eyes shut tight, as in prayer, as in sleep, a dream that outlives reality, an image to enter me like a knife, like a nail, hammering in till it finds its reply, taking my body like breath, like the strong kiss of a bridegroom, like death in all its finality. Someone is at work in me, translating this corrupt language of my body, the dark, bitter words of my heart, into the pure language of that other place, where every word is a radiant arrival that draws me across the threshold and claims me as its own.
Miriam, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Meredith. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Miriam Weiwei Lo, reading one of her three poems nested under the title Home. You heard her first one a little earlier in our conversation, and if you'd like to read on, you can find the full text by following the link from the Soul Search website. Miriam is based in Fremantle, where she teaches creative writing. Her first book won the Western Australian Premier's Award for Poetry back in 2004. Her most recent is called Who Comes Calling, and it includes her work in memory of Katrina Miles. Miriam also wrote an academic piece about poetry in the face of trauma. It's called Speaking About the Unspeakable, and you'll find a link to that on our website. Home isn't always a safe place for people, is it? And if hearing Miriam and I talking about domestic and family violence raised anything at all for you, remember you can find support by calling 1-800-RESPECT at any time. On Radio National, this is Soul Search. My name's Meredith Lake, and I've been talking with Miriam Weiwei Lo about ideas of home, what she called the paradoxes of broken wholeness, and about the art, or at least the poetry, of coming home to ourselves. For now, thanks to producers Hong Jiang and Rowan Salmon for all their work behind the scenes, and special thanks to both poet Miriam Weiwei Lo and composer Naomi Brown. They've both been so generous in sharing their work with you and me today. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'll catch you again for Soul Search by podcast, online, and on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.